My Life as an Animal, Serialization, Week 5. This episode is brought to you by animalaid.org.uk, who campaign peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promote cruelty-free living.
It's now time to continue our audiobook here on UK Health Radio, My Life as an Animal, written by Andrew Tyler and read by Jim Smith.
My Life as an Animal. All the national newspapers were delivered to the office each morning so that we could check for DFW relevant stories. UDI was dominating global headlines, was provoking disputes in workplaces like our own about whether Smith was right or wrong. For me, he was wrong. Wrong to set his face against what recent Tory Prime Minister Harold Macmillan had called the winds of change. Smith and Co. had no interest in fresh winds. They preferred the gassy stench of the current arrangement, under which the privileges of a colonial elite were safeguarded at the expenses of impoverished African majority. I don't pretend I knew very much about this or any other political matter in those days, other than what I read in the papers and saw on TV. But however complicated the history of what was then called Rhodesia and is now Zimbabwe, and irrespective of what it was to become and the reasons why, I could not stay silent after one of the editorial team, a pinched-mouthed economics specialist called Roger Gromyko, made an ugly little speech. He wished to set out why the Smith regime, composed of sophisticated, altruistic whites, were morally bound to run the country on behalf of the blacks who, after all, were like willful children who understood very little and could not be trusted to safeguard their own future. Gromyko rounded off with something like, "I'm afraid they are as stupid as they are physically repulsive." Thinking back, I recognise why this hateful man got to me. It was simple. No group of people, whatever their colour or circumstances, should be talked of in such poisonous terms. My own generation of post-war Jews had to contend with both brazen and genteel religious hatred. We even had the wartime fascist leader, Oswald Mosley, the 6th Baronet, who was comfortable in English aristocratic circles, come down with his black shirts in July 1962 to Dawston's busy Ridley Road market in Hackney. There he tried on some street-level demagoguery. I live locally and got caught up in what became a violent rout. Mosley was forced to exit after just 3 minutes. Violence aside, in everyday working and social situations, when you were with people who didn't know you were Jewish, there was the worry that one of them would make a casual wisecrack or tell a joke, the punchline of which would be essentially, "Aren't Jews disgusting?" The newsroom team were having their say on UDI. And, to one degree or another, they all supported Smith's breakaway move. After a couple of minutes, I could hear my voice bouncing off the walls and realised everyone else but Gromyko had fallen silent. In response to my objection to the treatment of the black population, Gromyko patronised me. "These things are complicated," he said. But I was to bear in mind the long-term damaging effects that could result from extending democracy to a people not yet ready for it. We smacked that one back and forth and, perhaps surprised that I wouldn't be silenced, he pulled me down into the cloudy waters of Rhodesia's colonial past and threw at me dates of significance and landmark events. But because I'd just read up on these things in the morning broadsheets, I could offer a view on, say, Southern Rhodesia's 1923 constitution and even correct him on a couple of points. I don't say our exchange left him vanquished, but certainly it left me intact. When the rest of the editorial team weren't looking, Rob, the page layout man, congratulated me with a conspiratorial lift of his eyebrows and a silently mouthed, "Well done." He was the office joker who, during a heavy rainstorm, would pick up his phone and, in a bellowing voice, demand to speak to God, who he would then berate for sending us lousy weather. Usually there'd be a thick strand of dried-out cow gum dangling from each nostril during these exchanges. Rob was the man who dared to rebuke his God. He described himself as Roman Catholic, but when it came to more earthly things, he kept his conscience under wraps. Perhaps he was saving it for a rainy day. I worked on the two-man monthly, The Office, for 15 or so months. It gave me the chance to engage with the mechanics of magazine production, page design, printer's proofs, commissioning outside contributors, keeping within a budget, and so on. These were grown-up things for a 19 going on 20-year-old to be doing. My editor came in periodically to coach me. Otherwise, he was in a place unknown, hating his love of the booze. That he managed to get to the office at all was a wonder, considering how yellow and liver-worn he looked. It was an act of conscience by a tired and ailing man to want to give me, the new boy novice, the help I needed. My North American adventure was about to begin, and I could never have guessed how deep and strange the experience was to be. It would be, in essence, an old-fashioned search of the heart of the spirit, a search for a reason. There had been that stricken bear on a pickup truck in British Columbia, shot through the heart. The giant hailstones on the Manitoba Highway, drinking coffee and typing poolside in a Memphis motel, making love in a Toronto park, cleaning offices through the night in Century City, Los Angeles, sleeping five to a hard bug-infested garage floor in San Francisco, redistributing wealth to the street from America, Inc., spinning my mind with pills, mushrooms and weed, encores in a smart Islington pub theatre, hitchhiking from city to city, relaxed chatter with Stevie Wonder and John Lennon, gushing emotion from Marianne Faithfull, rushing my overdose writer friend to Paddington Hospital, and, as well as much else, the Hollywood dystopian ending in which the superb average white band drummer Robbie McIntosh died at a show-busy gathering from a dose of bad drugs. And then, there I was saying no to a party in the desert with Elvis Presley. What next? That 29-year-old me somehow knew that the dramas were not yet over. And he was right.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
How to be a grown-up. I had spied my 30th birthday on the horizon and heading in my direction long before it arrived. It made me a little queasy thinking about what the landmark event signified. 30 is the number that divides the inspirational, chaotic years of youth from the years of responsible adulthood. But if adult caution is unexciting, continuing to run around unfettered after the age of 30 can be unbecoming. A youth hitchhiking with his cardboard destination sign will get a ride quicker than an older man with the same sign, because the youth makes you think freedom, adventure, whereas the older guy makes you think escaped prisoner, wife murderer. It's unjust, but it's how the gears of social conformity grind down those who stand out against the crowd. So here I was, nearly 30 years old, and trying to lay a portion of the blame on society for my feelings of being stalled. My writing was stalled in the sense that I was uncertain what great universal theme I should be tackling next. My love life was a smouldering wreck because I'd foolishly gone on believing that a long-distance union with a woman from Memphis I met 3 years earlier had a future. Her name was Iris, and we'd found each other when I was in her hometown, attending a gathering of musical obsessives, billed as a rock writers' convention. The time we spent together, against a backdrop of babbling critics and sweltering afternoon thunderstorms, was dreamlike and intoxicating. And not wanting the feeling to end, I delayed acknowledging to myself that the prospects of her moving to join me in alien London with a young child were as remote as me laying down roots in Tennessee. The way out of my mess was not to think harder, but to get physical. I would get a bicycle and go on a long journey during which I collect foot blisters and saddle sores, but also generate enough energy to vaporize my troubles. The bike was a 30th birthday gift from my flatmate at the time, Pete Erskine. It was a fine-looking lightweight machine that Pete had himself assembled at the specialist bike shop in West London he'd been working at through the summer. I first met Pete when we were together for a few months at Disc and Music Echo from mid-1971. I remember two kinds of Pete, the one who, most of the time, was witty, clever and vulnerable, and the other Pete who was haughty and waspish. And then there were those periodic Wildman episodes, an example being his response to a new single he heard being played at the NME offices and which wasn't to his taste. He pulled out an air pistol and shot the turntable dead. Then he shot several more of that week's releases for target practice. Ultimately, Pete became his own target. He fell too hard for the grubby late-night allure of the rock critic's world, and in his bid to keep up, developed a heroin habit that led him on a self-consuming chase to satisfy a need that couldn't be satisfied, and ease a pain that would be there for as long as the drugs were there. As for my own journey, I plotted a route that was 77 miles long and ran from my Maida Vale West London base to a cottage called Nirvana on the Military Canal near Rye in Sussex. Nirvana was the home of ex-NMEers Tony and Kate Tyler. Tony had agreed to be my collaborator on a script for a television play I had been working on speculatively for some time. That's to say, I had no commission for it, but hoped to find a buyer once it was completed. It told the true story of a bare-knuckle boxer called Daniel Mendoza, who was champion of England from 1792 to 1795. Before Mendoza, prize fighters generally squared up to each other like stone monuments and slugged it out in the ring until one of them gave in or was unable to return to the fray within 30 seconds of a knockdown. Fights could last hours and dozens of rounds. Mendoza, who was just 5'7" tall, brought mobility to the ring. He circled, ducked, and sidestepped his opponents, overcoming them with an accumulation of blows, many of which they didn't see coming. He was the first middleweight to triumph in the heavyweight division, and for 3 years was unbeatable. As a Jew of Portuguese descent, he brought pride to his co-religionists, a people whose social status was the familiar one of suspect aliens, who was simultaneously regarded as being contemptibly weak but also threatening. Mendoza almost certainly buoyed up to another put-on constituency by acting as a second for a fighter called Tom Molyneux, a freed Virginia slave. My telling of the Mendoza story should have been with verve and dash and glossy colours. Instead, the issue of historical accuracy had come to dominate all other considerations and now had me hemmed in. Tony, thankfully, had read a lot of history and wasn't troubled by it. The accuracy issue for him was a delicious puzzle to be enjoyed. The plan was to ride my new bike down to Nirvana in a single day, talk through the script, have a few drinks, sleep off the aching in my limbs, and then take the bike back to London the next day on the train. First, though, I needed cycling practice on busy roads, something I'd never had before. Pete took me on 3 or 4 stiff training runs, the last of them after dark, in the rain. I did my best to follow him as he threaded a path through the unresponsive stream of traffic, seizing a metre or two of territory wherever it would secure his position, then drawing back from speeding imbeciles who'd run you down if you mildly inconvenienced them. I could see there were more ways a cyclist could come to grief than I ever would have imagined, but I felt foolishly immortal on my little two-wheeler. I would not be deterred. I set off on an October Sunday morning at about 6:30. There was no planned arrival time. I just wanted to get there the same day. After 10 or 12 minutes and still in the foothills of London West Nine, I detected the first signs of tiredness in my legs But if I started riding defensively this early, I would be done for. I distracted myself with other thoughts. I dreamed of a bowl of date pudding covered in hot custard and run through with golden syrup, and being garlanded at Journey's End by Kate and Tony, whose effusive compliments I brushed aside. On the Bayswater Road approaching Marble Arch, the repeated stops in dense traffic exposed my instability. I stumbled and was unable to stop the front wheel and its mudguard making contact with the shiny bodywork of a powder blue sporty MG. It was being driven by an expensively dressed youth who had an unhappy-looking young woman beside him. The traffic stopped once again. I braked, but my attempt to dismount cleanly was foiled by my left foot getting caught in the pedal strap. I did an involuntary juddering foot-stamping routine as I tried to stop myself from crashing to the ground. Embarrassed, I flashed an "aren't I a dope" grin at the MG driver, who read it as me mocking him after having deliberately driven into his bodywork. His response was to pursue me all the way to Park Lane, driving aggressively inches from my back wheel and then alongside me. I somehow kept upright and gave him a thumbs up as he accelerated into the distance. Daniel Mendoza's first fight was reported to have been about a matter of pride. He fought on behalf of his employer, an all-gate tea dealer who was being menaced by a porter. The story goes that the porter was trying to land the dealer with a bill twice what it should have been. The porter's manner was offensive and ungentlemanly, and when he challenged the tea dealer to settle the matter with their fists, Dan accepted the challenge in place of his boss. He was just 16 years old. A makeshift ring was erected and, after a duel lasting some 45 minutes, the well-beaten porter gave in and Dan's reputation was on the way to being made. I was a short distance from Vauxhall Bridge, moving smoothly along Grosvenor Place and making good time. After a brief detour for roadworks, I crossed the river into South London. My muscle pain was gone, and whatever trepidation had hung about me as to the wisdom of this journey, that had also gone. The part of South London I was passing through on that 1976 October morning, Kennington, Elephant and Castle, the New Kent Road and the Old Kent Road, had been remade in recent years with mechanical diggers, cranes and wrecking balls. But for a while longer, the old ways lived on in the little linen and hat shops in which the sales staff may have worked for 20, even 30 years, and had got their job in the first place through a relative. The 1970s were the days of the everlasting sale, when everything was 20% off the supposedly regular price. Televisions, radiograms, and gramophones pretended to be items of furniture, their functioning parts coyly concealed inside austere wooden cabinets, or in cabinets made from something pretending to be wood. I cycled past grocery stores with stained and mildewed fascias that looked as if they ran on pre-supermarket lines. Before Mr. Sainsbury learnt modern retailing from America, you'd line up for a pound of butter and a block of cheddar, after which you'd join the bacon queue. And when you'd got your Danish rindless greenback or whatever it might be, you'd line up once again for your canned and dry provisions. John Collier and Burton stores were on every main high street, selling cheap made-to-measure suits for working-class gentlemen. And there was that especially curious feature of South London. It had no underground trains, no tube stations. People got about by bus, which meant long waits at shelters. North Londoners also went by bus, but millions each day had that underground experience. They walked the windy tunnels to the platforms, hoping their train wasn't so full that they would have to force their way into a carriage and risk winding up huddled inside another commuter's armpit. By the time I'd passed through Lewisham into Sidcup, it was feeling a little like country. I cruised down a steep hill, and on beholding a corresponding incline at the bottom, paused to consider what my legs and lungs had to do to reach the top. A lean, wiry man in his 30s drew up on his bike alongside me. Tired? He asked. Only momentarily, I said, and then I get my puff back. You shouldn't get tired, he said. I told him my journey was one of more than 70 miles. I was a novice and needed to pace myself. You know why you get tired, he pressed on. No, tell me. Because you expect to. Yes, I expected to, and it happened. His principal advice was to speed up rather than slow down whenever I was feeling exhausted. He mentioned some advisory cycling body with which he supposedly had a senior role. He talked about attending overseas cycling conferences, but I suspect he was a fraud. I did try his work harder when you're exhausted approach, but it did the opposite to what he promised. Signs for Gatwick appeared, and then a roundabout took me onto the old London Road. I was getting saddle sore, and while I didn't want to think about it, my bike was 3 or 4 inches too small for me, even after raising the saddle as high as it would go. I opted for another mental distraction, chocolate and banana cake with black cherries. I stopped at a roadside cafe for a cup of strong tea and ate another of my fish paste sandwiches. I was now seeing the flattened bodies of country animals who'd failed to outrun the traffic. In a 5-minute stretch, I saw 2 pheasants, a fox, and a rabbit. Later, there would be a badger with a trickle of blood running from his nose, a magpie, and another rabbit. I didn't realize it at the time, but the many horses I saw standing motionless in fields or peering over roadside fences as I cycled by, their lives were often spent doing little more than what they were doing that day. It was and still is commonplace to keep horses without equine company, day after featureless day. The drone of traffic, their permanent soundtrack, and often with no shelter from the rain or blazing sun. Maybe for the little chestnut-hacking pony whose nose I stroked while offering him grass, there had been a teenage girl who'd outgrown him, who was suddenly too big for her forever precious equine friend. And so while she was looking the other way or was up at uni, her dad would arrange for a couple of dealers to load the pony onto a lorry that was bound for a Somerset horse slaughterer, and that would be the end of the chestnut pony. I've seen horses slaughtered, shot in the head, throats cut, then shackled and hoisted by one leg. To make the killing of discarded home county ponies more palatable, the slaughter is labelled elective equine euthanasia. The Ladybird Book of Horses, published in the mid-1960s, conjured up for its young readers something more generous and reciprocal. Without the useful horse, wrote no-nonsense author Nancy Scott, the whole history of the world would be different. It has been more than a friend of man for thousands of years. It has been his essential partner. Thanks, partner. As the county of Kent drew closer, the route grew more wooded and some of the roads narrower and more shaded under canopies of gently arching branches. The road signs were now for places like Rootham and Paddock Wood. It had been a bright October day, but I could sense a chill setting in as the afternoon wore on. I was concerned now about reaching Kate and Tony's cottage at a sensible hour. Having pedalled at what seemed like a demanding pace from early morning, I was on course to get there no earlier than 11 p.m. Maidstone came and went, and 4 close-together roundabouts took me momentarily in the direction of Hastings, then back towards Hawkhurst. The light was fading, not a good time to discover that the batteries in my rear and front lamps were flat. I carried on cycling, despite the darkening skies, being in no mood to be defeated by something so trivial. There had to be a shop, or even a pub, that would sell me replacements. Soon I could see very little, although I sensed I was on a narrow road above a village, and there were trees either side. I hit a ditch and landed on my knees and elbows, groped my way back onto the road and got back on the bike. A dozen zigzagging meters later, I came off again. I was by now mud-splattered and demented. There had to be batteries somewhere close. My innards were shrieking. But the same part of me was admitting it was time to concede. There was a hotel and pub less than 100 metres further along the road. But even if it had rooms full of batteries, it would still be reckless to carry on in the dark. Uncertain where I was with 10 miles of my journey remaining, I booked a room and phoned Tony and Kate to tell them of my revised plans. Happily, the bike was still roadworthy the next morning. The frame had faint scratches and dents, but it ran as before. I got to Tony and Kate's by midday, ready to deal with a rush of daft quips about failing batteries. Instead, and before I'd taken off my coat, Tony came at me in the guise of a boastful, resentful man called John Spencer, one of Mendoza's bare-knuckle victims. Spencer's complaint, as voiced by Tony, was that he had been drugged by Mendoza's second before the fight, leaving him too weak to give a proper account of himself. "Your behaviour, sir, was most un-English," Spencer bellowed. "You took the purse and the glory when it was mine. I call you a thief." "You, sir, will withdraw that slur." "I shall leave my slur where it is, sir," and so on. Over lunch, we warned each other about enjoying it too much and producing adolescent pastiche instead of convincing dialogue. "How did it all end for Mendoza?" Tony asked. "The way a boxer's career usually ends," I answered. "Mendoza had made and spent a fortune. He gave exhibitions and lessons, worked as a pub landlord, appeared in Panto, and after a 14-year ring absence, couldn't resist one more grudge match when he was a day short of his 56th birthday. He lost in 12 rounds. Mendoza died when he was 72, in wretched poverty. I look forward to exchanging folios with you, sir," said Tony as I readied myself to leave. "Upon my word," I answered, "I too wish for precisely that." I could see this could become irritating. 3 days after my visit, I received the first Mendoza pages from Tony. I made changes and sent them back, with 4 new pages of my own that pushed the story along by 15 seconds of screen time. In true Ernie Wise style, I had 2 other plays on the go, each one in need of a patron with belief and connections. One was set in a small London West End hotel, whose mother-dominated daytime porter was about to have an extraordinary encounter with a visiting Hollywood star. The other was a love story centred on a couple living rough on the streets of Whitechapel, East London. Throwing myself into playwriting and setting aside the newspaper work made sense because of the foggy, dreamy state I was in at the time. Journalism called for a brittle, snap-judgment sensibility. It fed on stories that described, in the main, easily understood events and people whose ambitions and failings were recognisable. The characters in plays, at least the ones I was writing, began in the imagination with soft outlines and with motivations that were unclear. After that would come a chance to explore, invent, and depending on subject matter, determine the beginning and end of people and situations. I also liked, let's face it, writing about themes I chose for myself and working to my own deadlines. Maybe it was because playwriting encouraged in me such dreaminess that I developed an appetite for political tracks of the most severe kind. It began innocently when someone gave me, as a joke, a 30-page hardcover booklet reproducing a speech delivered by Mao Zedong on December the 25th, 1947. Don't they know it's Christmas, to the Central Committee of the Communist Party of China. Its title was The Present Situation and Our Tasks, and it was Mao's progress report on the 20-year struggle with the anti-communist forces of Chiang Kai-shek. From page 1, Mao's text was replete with period piece insults. The People's Liberation Army, Mao's forces, had turned back the wheel of counter-revolution, US imperialism and its lackey, the Chiang Kai-shek bandit gang, and sent it down the road to destruction. And it has pushed the wheel of revolution forward along the road to victory. Further on, he describes the dismal economic state of the country he would later take complete control of, and why, as an interim measure, elements of the bourgeoisie needed to be tolerated, and non-monopoly capitalism permitted. The anti-imperialist Soviet Union, wrote Mao, was cherished by the world's broad masses, whereas US imperialism was drawing up a plan for enslaving the world, a plan for running amok like wild beasts in Europe and doing much else that was discreditable, all with the aim of starting a Third World War. An especially chilling aspect was the gap between Mao's absurdist comic book prose and the real-life slaughter and misery wrought by the gigantic opposing forces that were then at large. But while Mao's language is risible, especially to sophisticated Westerners in our own times, we sophisticates seemed oblivious to the strings that are jerking us one way. The Mujahideen are heroes, said the UK government, for driving the Soviets from Afghanistan. And then the other, the Mujahideen are terrorists, say the UK government, who are spreading their extremist poison throughout the region. We like the Mujahideen when their 10-year struggle to evict Soviet invaders succeeded in 1989. We stopped liking them from October the 7th, 2001, when it was invading US and NATO troops who were coming under attack by radical Islamists. The Mao volume came from a political bookshop on Acre Lane, Brixton. I called in and bought another dozen lively numbers. They were only a few pence each, including two more from Mao and some sombre tracts by Marx, Engels and Lenin. Muammar Gaddafi's Green Book spelt out plans for a state that had advanced beyond the party model and would instead be regulated by the people, whoever they were. And I even found a handful of mini-volumes on anarchism. One of them helpfully galloped through descriptions of the ideology's main strains, likening their multiplication to cell division in a healthy embryo. Among those subgroups were anarcho-syndicalism, anarcho-capitalism, individualism, collectivism, mutualism, syntheticism, and you get the idea. As part of my reading binge over the next 12 months, taking me to the end of 1977, I also fed on mainstream authors such as Anthony Sampson and Bernard Crick and social scientist Ivan Illich. I read A Life of Hitler and Keynesian Economics Made Easy. I even strayed as far as the New Testament and the Jewish esoteric texts of the Kabbalah. I read them because they provided brain nourishment and triggered thoughts and insights usually counter to what was being pressed on the reader by the author. I began as an ideological and spiritual agnostic, and finished the same way, though feeling well fed. But I needed a job now. No one was paying me to read books or even write plays about bare-knuckle boxers. The ideal job would be one where I could snatch moments to carry on writing, but done with permission rather than covertly. To my astonishment, I found precisely that job. It was as the after-office-hours receptionist in a recording studio called AdVision that was located at the back of Oxford Circus. AdVision cut its mark in a competitive industry by investing promptly in the newest and most coveted recording and sound equipment. And for that, as well as for its nimble touch of its in-house technicians, AdVision charged its client musicians and producers a zillion pounds per hour. From me, those customers got toasted sandwiches, coffee, and cartons of orange juice for free throughout the night. It was a friendly place to work. I could do my writing at the reception desk in the large open foyer. And as long as I was responsive to the studio users and locked up securely and set the alarm every night, no one troubled me. I still shared the Maida Vale house with Pete Erskine and his wife, Katie, and used the bike Pete assembled to pedal to work. The route took me through Marble Arch roundabout, which, in that busy hour before 6 p.m, was a scary torrent of rushing, swirling traffic that I preferred to navigate on an empty stomach. The one aspect of the job I found hard to swallow was the heavily processed, mummifying air that was our daily diet. It was dry, overheated, and probably alive with shoals of microbes. By the end of a shift, you were longing for the shock of cold, sweet night air that lay beyond the glass doors. But more than all that, the embodiment of the AdVision experience was, for me, War of the Worlds producer Jeff Wayne and his fragment-by-tiny-fragment approach to record-making. During the post-recording production phase, he or his engineer would play the same four-second sequence over and over throughout an entire night session, then, more than likely, repeat the same numbing exercise the following night. He seemed unperturbed by the shrinking of the world caused by his unremitting focus on something so minuscule. There was madness in his method, and if there was a name for what he had, it might be asymptomatic repetitive playback syndrome. But I'm not about to tell Jeff Wayne he got it wrong. War of the Worlds sold more than 30 million copies between its 1978 release and 2005. And it parked itself for 250 weeks in the UK's top 100 albums chart. I would have welcomed some of that momentum behind the Daniel Mendoza project. Our script had been doing the rounds of commissioning editors and independent producers for 4 months without anyone biting. "Early days," said Tony over the phone. "Plenty of time to despair." "I'm keeping my happy, hopeful face pinned on for a while," I said. Birthday Boy, the story of an encounter between an unworldly hotel receptionist and a beautiful Hollywood film star, was finished. That too was about to leave my grasp, first stop being a literary agent recommended by a bass player who I got talking to at an AdVision session. Is that really how life works? Chance meetings and random events determining what will be? The story of the rough sleepers who fall in love had given me problems. I couldn't get a sense of them beyond the clichés, the wine bottles and the bruised faces, the jostling, cursing madness. But tender things like trust and love itself had to be possible, even in the grimiest, most dysfunctional corners of that world. But then I remember two old mess drinkers I saw behind Waterloo Station, warming their hands over a dying fire, looking like ghosts from the 1930s, and I wondered how many of their tender feelings could possibly survive. My sense of such people was so flimsy, I'd feel like a con man writing about them. It was around the middle of June 1978 when I received a letter from a showbiz agency, whose name I no longer remember, telling me they had read Birthday Boy and asking if I'd like to come and talk about it. I felt a shiver from my skull to my heels, and a surge of energy so strong I could have raced up the side of a tall building unaided. Birthday Boy was, broadly speaking, a farce, and as well as self-pity, lust and vengefulness, it featured blow-up rubber sex toys that the day porter conversed with and took to bed. An even more emphatic influence on the day porter was that of his demanding, needy mother, who he once pitied but now saw as his jailer. The agency's office was in Soho, and the boss was an expansive silver-haired character in a loud check suit. After a dramatic pause, he told me how touching and humorous the script was, and that the lead role of the day porter would be perfect for a certain household name who the public loved as a great comic, but who, they didn't know yet, was also a great actor. "Very touching," the agent emphasized. "He has the skills to make you cry." I asked who he was referring to. When he said Norman Wisdom, I wanted to embrace and kiss him. "I loved him as a kid," I shouted. "You would still love him. All those early films." 3 evenings later, on July the 1st, 1978, there was an event in my life that was very much bigger than the fate of Birthday Boy. The woman who turned out to be Sarah, my future wife, came visiting my housemates, Peter and Katie Erskine. Or rather, she thought she might as well accompany her sister Lizzie, who was on a visit to the Erskines. Sarah brought her son, 7-year-old Davy, with her, and while he played with the Erskine's son, Sarah and I drew close. She told me afterwards that I was distracted and apparently unenthusiastic. But that would have been the shyness, in fact, the terror of getting wrong something that already felt so right. I won't rhapsodize about how she looked to me because it might overflow with mush and appear like I was simply trying to please her all these years later. But she did look beautiful and vibrant and full of ideas about how the world is and what it could be. We drew closer and I probably got nervous about swimming too far from the safety of the shore. At around 9 or 10 o'clock, I went home with her and Davy to her pretty flat overlooking Hampstead Heath. The following morning, the husband, from whom she was divorced and who was Davy's father, came to pick him up for the day. Sarah made us all coffee and we spoke together of both superficial and deep things. So, this really is how life works, I thought. Chance meetings and random events determining what will be.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
In the family way. If my life story were to be told as a movie, the weeks after I met Sarah would be the rom-com soft focus sequence, showing us relaxed in each other's company and nourishing our relationship with food and culture. The sequence would open with two glasses of fizzy wine clinking together. The glasses go to lips, the lips kiss, and we cut to a photographic gallery where there's an exhibition of images of the ocean floor that look extraterrestrial. Now we're trying out a mattress in a vast warehouse store, after which we're spellbound side by side at a South Bank Shostakovich concert. I clap when I'm not supposed to. Heads turn. Sarah smiles and I mouth the words, cultural tyranny. Her bedside clock reads 3:55 a.m. She's asleep. I'm locking AdVision Studios' big plate glass doors, then cycling uphill in near darkness. I tiptoe into her flat to find her awake. We embrace. The bedroom door closes. The penultimate shot is of Davy in deep slumber. The last one is of me running a bath. I've said goodbye to the grubby male living on his own, who was happy not to notice the advancing grime and combustible odours. I am living now in the company of a woman and her son. There was something very winning about Davy from the day we met when he was aged 7 years and 2 months. He was trusting and friendly. I came from nowhere to share breakfast and cuddles with his mother. Seeing us that way, he might have given in to a little stamped foot resentment on behalf of his father, Reg, whose marriage to Sarah ended in separation when Davy was 3. Reg was precious to Davy then, and always will be, but if his mother liked a man enough to bring him back to the flat, that was all the signalling Davy needed. My worries about what might have felt and imagined came from my own messy childhood. My mother's heart had been captured by a boyfriend who told her he'd move in with her, but only if the kids were moved out. And, hey presto, it was done. An orphanage in West Norwood being the handy institutional receptacle into which we were deposited. But Davy knows Sarah would kill all comers rather than give him up. This is a real family I've come to, and I find myself being welcomed into it. It was in that spirit that the 3 of us went to a great temple of a restaurant in London's Chinatown early on a Sunday afternoon in late October for a delayed celebration of my 32nd birthday. Davy had packed a few essentials, a fistful of metal cars and lorries, a scribble pad, and an early adventure of a new comic book superhero who donned a cloak of invisibility to get out of scrapes, but whose poor sales numbers resulted in him disappearing altogether after just a half a dozen issues. I'd been to the restaurant just once before. Halfway through my soup that time, I was invited to draw a ticket from a cloth bag the waiter and his manager were taking table to table. The whole thing was played out over the restaurant PA, so that other diners, there were perhaps half a dozen in that ailing emporium, could share in the pretend excitement. Declining the offer to take the microphone, I pulled out a ticket. The young waiter startled me with a shriek. "Lucky ticket, lucky, very lucky," said his manager. and put the mic at my mouth. "I am very grateful," I said woodenly. "I look forward very much to my meal." A smattering of applause came from some kitchen staff behind me. On this second visit, the cloth bag and its handlers once again came my way during the soup course, this time unamplified. "Get your lucky fingers ready," I said to Davy, indicating a forefinger and a thumb. Davy made his draw and won. He threw out his chest, shouted, "Oh yes, genius," and sprinted twice to the toilet door and back. I asked the manager if the rules allowed us to win a free meal while enjoying a previous free meal. "Yes, different free meal," he answered. "This could go on forever," I said to Sarah. "Wonton soup until the end of time. Not if we don't come anymore," she quipped. "Why can't we come anymore?" asked Davy. That triggered an episode of three-way giggling which turned semi-hysterical. "We will come again," I finally managed. "Okay," Davy said simply, picked up his pad and dashed off a stubbly portrait of my face. We were silent for a while, lost in thought. The spell was broken by a concussive thump caused by a car engine in trouble, but which sounded like the firing of a military cannon. "You never knew your father, did you?" I said. "Why do you suddenly ask?" "I was thinking about how we are different, but in other ways the same. I did volunteer work for the British Legion some years ago," she said quietly. "I'd been so upset by a photo of a First World War soldier who'd lost both his legs. Some of those men, they came back with the most terrible injuries, or they didn't come back. But it's not about peace, Poppy Day, for the people who run it. It's so they can do their marching and get their guns out. Sarah's father, John, was one of those who didn't come back. He was killed on a bombing mission in April 14, 1945, just 24 days before the war in Europe ended. He was 23. He was from Saundersfoot in South Wales, where his own father was a doctor. John was an accomplished landscape artist, although his career goal was to be an architect. In the photograph I've seen of him, he's a trim, smallish man in a Harris tweed jacket that's buttoned up awkwardly, while the knot of his tie is a little too hard at his throat. His hands are clasped lightly behind his back, and he's smiling into the sun. His wife Betty was more than 7 months pregnant with Sarah when he was killed and would have been off the scale hysterical, Sarah tells me, screaming and convulsive with grief. For the baby about to be born, it would have been like a shipwreck. Sarah was delivered by her paternal grandfather, Dr. Diffrid Hughes Pennant. A few weeks after the birth, feeling miserable and alone, Betty fled to friends in Edinburgh and left Sarah behind. Within the year, she had met and married a consultant engineer called Zed Bolton and returned to Saundersfoot with bad news for the Pennants. She and Zed would soon be leaving for the Sudan and taking Sarah with them. Zed had been commissioned to work on a large infrastructure project. The Pennants had cared for Sarah since she was born and assumed that would carry on. Taking the child from them now felt like kidnap, as Betty herself was to admit years later. They were devastated. Sarah, too, was badly affected. Davy wanted to know which was my favourite of two mini toy cars he'd brought with him to Chinatown. I chose one at random and he cried, "Ace choice!" "When I think of the trajectory your life followed as a young kid," I said to Sarah, dipping into a bowl of sugary Chinatown lychees, "no offence, but it looks like it was planned by a lunatic." "There wasn't a plan," she answered. "That's why I still couldn't read or write at all when I was 9 years old. I'd missed so much schooling." Her education gap grew as Betty and Zed followed a career path that took in Sudan, the Gold Coast, and South and Central America. The basics of reading and writing were finally learned at age 10 during a year's schooling in Arlington, Virginia. But she went backwards at a charmingly inept private establishment in Maidenhead. It was only when she came under the iron command of convent school nuns that measurable progress was made. But the years of lost ground and her inability to keep pace with contemporaries left her feeling stupid, an idea that grew in her like a canker until her first husband, Reg, killed it off by showing her how smart she was. If I dwell on these long-ago events, it's because Decades later, Sarah's bruised psyche is still evident. You see it in the furious passion with which she aroused on this topic of education and parental and political responsibility, and on many others, come to that. But the things that hurt people sometimes also sharpen their sense of purpose, and they give them the drive to find a way through the mess and noise that is all around us. Talking of bruised psyches, there was a letter for me in the Morning Post with news of my play, Birthday Boy, and it wasn't good. The Norman Wisdom agent had pitched it to the BBC, who sent it for assessment to a reader. His response was one of outstanding bitterness. As well as listing all the things I did badly, can't plot, can't write dialogue, characterization lousy, he seemed to want something bad done to me. Birthday Boy fell short of perfection. There, I've said it. But the BBC reader's snarling assault was surely not something I could take seriously. But I did. I'd been writing plays for at least 5 years. And if I couldn't get one sold with an agent in my corner who did business with Norman Wisdom, then what kind of intercession would it take? Unless, that is, the agent was a fraud whose real business was suckering gullible would-be playwrights. First, he softens them up with an unwarranted praise. Then, he shocks them into compliance with the kind of violently deranged letter I received this morning. Next, I expect he'll tell me I must defend my reputation by ensuring the contents of that letter go no further. And he can help on that. He knows people. He wants nothing from me, only general expenses. But that's just me playing around. The agent was fair and honest. It was simply time to bring the curtain down on my Ernie Wise playwriting epoch, which meant quitting AdVision and finding writing work that paid. I would do any kind of part-time work too, and I'd tell myself not to look back where the old glories lay. The only way is forward.
That was My Life as an Animal by Andrew Tyler and read by Jim Smith. Produced by Tom Davidson and adapted for UK Health Radio by Monkey Nut Audiobooks. My Life as an Animal is available on Audible and audiobook sites. Be sure to tune in next time to hear more from this title. This audiobook is published by Monkey Nut Audiobooks in Hampshire, UK.